to the program, Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Wednesday night, as always, when we're off for a Kings game, what happens? News, things to talk about. Oh, my goodness. I will tell you one thing I need to talk about these series of elections that happened. But I want to talk, the elections are not what's important. What's important is how it's being interpreted today. So I spent all day following up on the news, looking at everything. And if you've missed it, here's what's cooking. The Democrats won some races last night. And the Democrats, many Republicans, and a lot, I mean, truly, a lot of pundits in the media think that this is a sign of something huge. They think this is a sign that the Trumpster is in trouble. They think this is a sign that maybe even, I mean, all hyperbole aside, literally, there are people that think this is the end of the Republican Party. And they couldn't be more wrong. Let me unpackage this for you, because we have to do this carefully, step by step. If you'd like to be too on the program, anything here that you'd like to talk to me about, 800-222-5222 is the phone number, and Sam at SamNation.com is the email. I do check that during the show, so if you have something you'd like me to address, I will get back to you. I will check it, and I will get back to you. Now, the biggest race, there were two governorships that were up for grabs. There are no national races in the sense that there isn't a congressional seat or a senatorial seat or anything like that. Nothing. This has nothing to do with Congress. From all the hullabaloo, you would think that these were some huge elections that happened. These were state and local races. Now, the two big ones happened in New Jersey and in Virginia. And I am sick and tired of people telling me that these are purple states. You know the expression of purple state? A purple state is one that is perhaps red, perhaps blue. You mix the two colors together. Remember art class in the third grade? You get purple. There it is. And this is used politically to mean these are states that could be toss-ups. Could go one way, could go the other. Now, there are some purple states out there. New Jersey certainly isn't one of them, and neither is Virginia. But Sam, Virginia's in the South. No, Virginia's in the swamp. Washington, D.C. is in the middle of Virginia. Well, it's on the coast, but that is the heart. That exactly, the people that live outside of D.C., not everybody lives inside of the district. There are a lot of people that are fed by the status quo, by establishment politics, that live in Virginia. It's not a red state. It's not a Republican state. But the bigger issue in all of this, let's talk about Virginia for a minute, because a lot of attention has been put there. And there's a guy, the guy who ran on the Republican side, is Ed Gillespie. Now, okay, so he lost, and he lost by a fair number of points. It's a decisive defeat. And it's being shown to mean that Trump is going, this Trump's in trouble. The voters have turned their backs on Trump because Trump endorsed Gillespie. And you've got a lot of people saying, look, Trump can't talk the way he talks. He can't use the kind of language that he uses. He can't be who he is. It is turning away middle class, suburban, upper middle class, educated voters. This is what the Washington Post this morning. In their post-most, I get this digest every morning from the Washington Post, and it's always hilarious because it is absolutely, there are some people who actually believe this is true. So here's what it starts with. The big idea, Tuesday was the best day for Democrats politically since Barack Obama won re-election in 2012. Well, they're right about that, but it's pretty freaking depressing for the Democrats if last night was the best night they've had in 4 years, okay? 5 years. Here's what they say. Democrats desperately needed some wins after they went all in on a House special election and lost. Last night they got them. But they, The key thing that happened, and no one's addressing this, is that Gillespie, the Republican that ran, is an establishment guy. Do you know who campaigned for him? You know who he called to have campaigned for him? Marco Rubio and George W. Bush. No one wants that. George Bush Republicanism has been totally repudiated. It's gone. It's dead. We tried twice to unseat Obama with, you know, George W. type politics or politicians, and it didn't work either time. The only reason that there's a Republican in the White House is because Trump's a different guy. He's got bold ideas. He's a populist. He's speaking a language that the lower middle class and working class Americans understand. And he's talking tough, big on America. People like that. Believe it or not, I believe a number of people would have gone to vote for the Republican, whoever he is, if he had embraced Trump more. They've got it upside down. They think that because Gillespie lost, it's bad news for Trump. It's not like that at all. Gillespie lost because he was trying to distance himself from Trump. He was trying to be the anti-Trump. He was trying to be the more reasonable candidate. Gillespie, you know what he was in a previous life? He's a lobbyist. Ed Gillespie is a lobbyist. And then I believe he was the chair of the Republican Party. And that's it. He's a political hack. Political hacks are very inauthentic and extremely out right now in Republican politics. Republican hacks don't win. Remember that. Even all these special elections that have gone down, it's always the maverick outsider, and it's the right wing reformer that gets the job, gets elected. It's not the establishment Republican. So what happened? Bunch of Democrats showed up and a bunch of Republicans stayed home. When you do that, I can tell you just numbers wise, it's very difficult for the Republican to win. The Democrats, yes, the Democrats were all excited to sock it to Trump to score a big win. So there was huge turnout. But we know that. We know that Democrats don't like Trump. That's not news. There's nothing interesting about that. No. So instead, Democrats got very excited, wanted to make a big statement, wanted to show up. They did show up, in fact. And the Republicans, the ones that showed up, they weren't excited about their candidate. Because their candidate was just more of the same old than and I'm not even saying, by the way, Trump lost Virginia last year. This is something no one is talking about because then you can't use it. Ooh, see, they're turning against Trump. Like, he lost Virginia. It's not a red state. It's a Democratic state. Very interesting stuff in how it's being spun. The news is always repackaged to fit their narrative. It's completely retold. And I'm noticing today, even on Fox News, this is the Democrats had a big night. The Democrats had a big night. I'm looking at it. How? You know that there was they're making a big deal out of the race. Which one was this? This is also in Virginia, in the state house, the state body of representatives. Where do I have it? Oh, yeah. So there's a gal that won who is a transgender candidate. Oh, what's her name? I have it here. Danica Rome. And she wins, okay, over a guy who's literally 150 years old. He's been there forever. He calls himself Virginia's chief homophobe. That's his words, not mine. What an idiot. Who he doesn't deserve to be there. Who calls him? It's not even. And by the way, she, for the most part, ran on issues like traffic, you know, important local issues that matter to people. If I'm a voter and I want the right person in office, I don't know that he's the right person. Forget party label. So they're using that race. Oh, the other one that tickled me. I was talking about New Jersey earlier. So the lieutenant governor, the Republican lieutenant governor, Chris Christie is out. He's done. Okay. the lieutenant governor, the Republican, his number two in government, ran against someone else, a Democrat, a guy named Philip Murphy. Philip Murphy won. Yeah, I don't know if you know this about New Jersey, and they're making a big deal about this as, again, being another sign that the tide is turning against Trump. Please. It is unfathomable how unpopular Chris Christie is. Chris Christie is literally the most despised man in New Jersey. Why? Well, the Republicans, the Democrats all hate him. I mean, he went after the unions. He made some tough moves that won him no friends on the left. And then, do you remember this guy's the guy who stabbed Mitt Romney in the back? Remember when Mitty was running and next thing you know, there's Chris Christie, you know, walking arm in arm with Barack Obama, and then that's the rest is history. It was a big problem. And then he had the Bridgegate scandal. If you remember this, he shut down a bridge just to spite a politician. The soccer mom, a gal in his office, went to jail or got some jail time. Unbelievable. This guy is despicable. Chris Christie literally is a scumbag. So anyone attached to him, anyone who has any taint on them from his administration, is not going to win. But nobody's talking about that. They want to turn this into a story that the sky is falling and that Trump is in trouble. It's not that at all. Not at all. Now, big part of the story is polling. Polling, polling, polling. All I've heard today is polling and exit polling. All the questions that they ask people when they're, you know what exit polling is? When they leave, you go and you vote. And some annoying guy comes up to you with a clipboard and is like, hey, can you tell me, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? When did you make up your mind? Was it now? Was it 4 weeks ago? Okay, all this stuff. If you've ever had that happen to you, by the way, by the time you've already waited in line to vote, what do you do? No. And by the way, who do you not get with exit polling? You don't get the mail-in vote, right? You don't get absentee ballots. So it's not accurate, and I also am convinced that these polls are all, I don't trust them one bit. They're as crooked as they can be to push an agenda. But the polls are saying that people are turning against Trump. It's really funny. So for example, in the Virginia race, where you have, I think the guy won by some 56% or whatever it was. So the Democrat won. And then there was an exit poll, and they're touting this. Let's see if I've got this. This is hilarious. They're touting it as some incredible thing. Well, that 37% of voters really wanted to stick it to Trump. I mean, that was the number. It was 37%. Like, they did. This was their protest vote against Trump. So that's not even a significant portion. I mean, it is a significant, but it's not nearly most of the voters that went and voted for the candidate were voting just to spite Trump. Just one little disingenuous statistic that's being used without context. And this is something we fight over here on Grapple With on the program, because it's that ridiculous. So, as you are moving forward, listening to all of this, what does this mean prospectively for next year? Because, you know, yesterday signaled a year since Trump got reelected. I mean, elected, excuse me. I'm already moving on to 2020. So Trump, a year ago, it happened. The election result that no one, except for me, saw coming. They're talking, the big deal right now is that come the midterms, there's all the House seats are up for re-election, right? You get the House, a bunch of people in the House are up for re-election. They all go up. There's a big election. And every new incumbent president typically loses a certain number of House seats. Reagan even lost in 82, lost, I think, something like 24 or 25 House seats. Barack Obama, he lost a ton. I think he lost something like 60 or 65. In his first midterms. It happens. There's pushback against an incumbent president. It doesn't mean that the incumbent president doesn't get reelected. So the way I read all of this is that, one, Democrats have had their clock clean now. You know, in the last year, it hasn't been a good year. So, of course, when you're down and out, any good news is good news that you want to hold on to and that you want to just just keep very close to your heart and very excited about. I get that. But there's this wishful thinking. They are so fixated on cutting Trump down and having Trump fail and having Trump get run out of town, hopefully before his term is up, but certainly not get reelected, that they engage in this like fantasist, you know, thinking. And it's not logical. It isn't. If it was logical, they would look at the candidates, they'd look at the local races, they'd look at the makeup of voters and go, yeah, well, that was a predictable result. You know, there was no chance a Republican was going to win. That's not part of the story. And it's not part of the story because Democrats want to paint this as a giant black eye for Trump. It's not. Not at all. Okay, don't go anywhere. I've got reactions. Great sound bites coming right up. Don't go anywhere. We'll get into all of that right after this.
News. Talk. Evolve. 790 KABC.
Yeah, Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. If the Republicans had lost a race in Utah or in Alabama or, you know, Kentucky, then we can talk. Especially if they ran candidates who were anti-establishment, then we can talk. But you know, I think the opposition here. What I'm getting at here is all the dissecting that is going on about the election results last night. I didn't think these races were important enough to even talk about on air before they happened. I'm not just now trying to change the narrative to suit me. I for specific reasons, I've got 2 hours a night with the Kings. I don't even get to talk with you guys every night. I've a limited amount of time of all the things that are going on in the world. That is how insignificantly I viewed this before the fact. Ed Gillespie is boring to me. He's a nobody. He's an establishment party Republican who Trump supported because he has to. And this is another part of this that just bothers me. Oh, Trump's distancing himself now from Gillespie after he lost. Well, Trump can't say before the race, I think you're a swamp rat and a loser. He can't do that because he's not as irrational of an actor as everybody makes him out to be. He has to carry water. It's what you do in politics. He gets it. Carrying water for people that you think are dolts happens all the time. It happens on both sides of the aisle. So don't even start with me on that point. But I love how now he's, and what does he say? He goes, well, hey, if I was Trump, I'd be thinking, hey, you should have embraced me. You should have let me hold rallies with you. You should have let me come out there and really do this thing right. Instead, Gillespie was too busy comrading around with W and little Marco. I'm talking about Senator Rubio, in case you're offended by the moniker. So that's a no-go. Senator Rubio is not somebody who rural Virginians are going to be like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's the guy that reminds me. And by rural Virginians, I mean rural Republican Virginians. They don't look at Marco Rubio and go, man, that guy really excites me about being part of this party. That guy really makes me want to get out there in the polls. Remember why Trump won? Besides, you know, the Dems running a total loser. Trump won because he had an excited base that wasn't on anyone's radar. And he had an excited base because the guy, almost with unbelievable energy, traversed the country up and down, left and right, frenetically, doing rally after rally after rally. I don't know when he slept. I don't know when he ate. I don't know when he had any time for himself, but he did it. And in my opinion, Gillespie, as I was sort of observing this thing from the corner of my eye, I think he phoned it in. I mean, he was doing a very traditional campaign. Yeah. Oh, by the way, we got that clip. Robbie Mook, you know, this is the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton. But a day before the election on Monday, this is what he said. He was on CNN with Don Lemon talking about what he thought would be the I don't know, the meaning, the signal sent by the results of this election. And by the way, this is Monday, so this is a day before the election, before it was a big win in the Democrats' column, so to speak. And this is what Robbie Mook said about it.
I think oftentimes we blow these things up a little too big afterwards. There will be important signs of how the midterms will go, mm-hmm. but winning this race, actually, I'll give you an example. We won Terry McAuliffe's race in 2013, and the 2014 midterms didn't go so well for our party. So we'll see little signs, but this is not determinative.
He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. He's spot on. Because it's a really small sample, in my opinion. This is the few races. I think virtually all of these races are in, very Democratic areas, very blue, blue areas. And of course, when you do not have an exciting candidate on the other side, and you've got a lot of Democrats who are pissed off at Trump, which I absolutely concede that point. I actually think that's a critical point. Yes, Democrats are not happy with Trump. Yes, Democrats are excited to go to the polls and sock it to Trump, 100%. If you don't have a counterbalance to that, if you don't have any excitement on the other side, forget about it. Nothing's going to happen. All right, we got the news up next with John Wolfe. Don't go anywhere. More Sam Nation when we get back.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. Talk Radio 790. KABC.
Sam Berjofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC. All right, Wednesday night, after a series of elections around the country, they're being hailed by the media as a huge win for the Democratic Party. I don't think so, but I clearly disagree with DNC Chair Tom Perez. Listen to him here. This is last night. It's a little shrill, so I'm just warning you. I think this is hilarious. He is so excited that this is such great news that he's won the Virginia governorship race, or that his party has, and he's got a big message about this. Listen closely.
The Democratic Party is back, my friends. We're back big time, and we're back because we're organizing everywhere. We're mobilizing everywhere, in every zip code, in every corner of this commonwealth, in every zip code, in every corner of this country. You have sent a message tonight, not simply to the voters in the Commonwealth of Virginia. You have sent a message across the globe. Donald Trump, you don't stand for our values. The America that Donald Trump comes back to in a few days is far different than the America he left.
Now, you don't even have to be, I think, a dye-in-the-wool Republican to know that this is totally, totally nonsense. I agree with him only in the sense that this election does send a message. It just depends. I disagree with what the message is. The message is not an anti-Trump message. One message that I think that the Republicans need to understand is that if they continue to run candidates that are boring, vanilla, plain Jane, I don't even keep overusing the words, establishment candidates, they cannot run these people. These people are not electable. They're not electable because they do not excite voters. And this is the problem with politics. I think a lot of the people that put these races together, if you want to run for office, you got to hire all these pundits, not pundits, but the pollsters and political gurus, right? Consultants that tell you, here's how the numbers work out. We got to appeal to this group and that group and this issue and that issue. And oh no, that's toxic. We've pulled it. It's toxic. Everything Trump did in his campaign at the end of the day, not everything, but a lot of it, no guru, no political, consultant, anything like that would possibly ever be able it would never have suggested that be done. There's no way. No way in heck. So, in fact, the way it's right. It was completely unorthodox, but it was authentic. It was real. And people craved it because in this era of everything being, under a microscope, every word being parsed and dissected, people loved the fact that Trump was out there and just put himself out there. And for many people, he was saying things that they had always wanted to say themselves. So I think Perez is right. It's, there is a message being sent. And Republicans are going to continue to lose big in states and in elections that are really, are theirs to take. If they run McCain's, if they run Jeff Flake's. Look, Jeff Flake, Arizona is a right-leaning, Republican-leaning state. And Jeff Flake is quitting because he knows he can't get reelected. This does not mean that Jeff Flake will be replaced by a Democrat. This means that Jeff Flake has to be, replaced by somebody who wants to make America great again and can get on board, and be an authentic, aggressive candidate. It's plain and simple. So I think, I think that's the takeaway. But let them, they're of course going to crow about this. That is true. Oh, but the Republicans too. The Republican establishment here also is crowing about this race. They're actually excited that a bunch of Democrats won. I'm going to get into this a little bit when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Sam Rzhovsky here. I know you listen to the program. You hear me talking about sweet James Bergner, the one and only attorney that I trust for personal injury accident cases. Look, if you or a loved one has been hurt and you do not want to go at it alone. You don't want to try doing it on your own. You want to get the best. The guy that will take care of you is attorney sweet James Bergner. He's easy to talk to. That's very important, right? Because when you're calling a lawyer, sometimes they're a little grouchy and might talk over you and not listen to you and your needs. James will listen. He will take care of you very well. Got to keep his number handy. That's the most important part. You don't have his number, you can't reach him. 800-881-2021. 1-800-881-2021. Or visit his website, sweetjames.com. All right, Sam Rzhovsky talking about these the developments here of election last night, a series of elections last night, where a number of Democrats won some local races, including the governorship in Virginia and in New Jersey, both very Democratic states. Just want to point that out. Interestingly, what does this really mean to us here? Because we didn't have any races here in California that really have registered on it. So what does it mean to us? And it's really just exactly what I've been saying here. What I think people want to know is, what does this mean for, the politics of next year when a bunch of Congress is up for grabs? And one of the fears is that Trump is so unpopular that the Republicans are going to lose Congress. Now, I have another read for this that, by the way, nobody's saying, right? Maybe when it comes to the congressional race next year, it's not Trump that's unpopular. It's Congress that's unpopular. If I think about the logjam, the inefficiency, the do-nothingness that is in Washington, I don't think of Trump. I think of Mitch McConnell. I think of Paul Ryan. The more I've thought about this, really, what's the difference? Republicans, Democrats in Congress? not like the Republicans are getting Trump's agenda done. In some ways, the Republicans are, I dare say, bigger obstructionists than the Democrats. I mean, at least you know with the Democrats that you know that they're against you. But these Republicans cozying up to Trump and saying nice things and, oh, yes, we've got to get this done and make this our priority. And then behind closed doors, what do? Nothing, because they're seething about Trump. Listen to former Senator Rick Santorum. This is an inside Republican guy. Trust me when I tell you that what he's saying here is what a lot of members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, are thinking. Listen to this.
The rhetoric of this president, it is hurting him. Yep. It is hurting the Republican Party. And Republicans are telling him that. Democrat, everybody's telling him that. And tonight, the president needs to look at particularly suburban districts where this type of rhetoric, this type of, you know, schoolboy kind of in your face doesn't go over well among college educated suburban voters.
This is such nonsense. Two of Trump's most vocal critics, Mitt Romney and, of course, one and only Senator John McCain, both of whom lost the last two presidential races preceding Trump's. So the Republicans are very good at losing races. Yes. If I think of establishment Republicans, I think there is a bunch of people who have an exceedingly fine knack at totally failing. And that's great, right? I mean, if that's what you want, that's great. They're so obsessed with things sounding right and being polished and being highbrow. Losing suburban voters. What a bunch of hogwash. It's nonsense. And because it's factually incorrect. I mean, Trump picked up huge swaths of suburban voters. What do you think is the very first thing that happened on election night a year ago yesterday? Was he won Florida? Remember that? Losing huge swaths of suburban voters. Total nonsense. All right, don't go anywhere. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
News. Talk. Evolve. 790 KABC.
And welcome back. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Oh, there's some news today. Just to underscore what I mean by a do-nothing Congress, the Senate is already putting its brakes on the tax reform plan. And one of the ways that they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, it's called a phase. It's called phase-ins. Basically, delaying passing the bill, but delaying certain tax cuts from taking effect. And one of those tax cuts is the drop in the corporate rate. Now, the reason that they want to do a phase-in in 2 years, I'll tell you that. This is exactly the kind of spineless action that our politicians are capable of. Bush got suckered into this himself. When the Bush tax cuts were voted in, they were phased in over time. And it created a terrible economic problem, by the way. Because everybody in the economy goes, okay, all right, it's coming in 2 years. Well, we're not going to do anything for 2 years. Trump, if you're Trump, you've got to have immediate results, right? You have to have immediate results. And by the way, right now we're getting immediate results in the economy just on the hope and prayer that these results are coming. But if you vote in tax reform and it's there written in stone, nothing's going to happen until 2 years from now. That's when the economy takes a crap. And by the way, right, 2 years from now is approximately, we'll say add a few months to it, would be approximately 3 years into Trump's first term. See what kind of uncertainty that brings? Now, people who are making big economic decisions and moving around billions, if not trillions of dollars, what are they looking at? They're looking at permanency. They're looking at, will this tax rate be around long enough to mean anything to my business? And if the answer is, well, okay, well, maybe Trump's going to get reelected, maybe not. So potentially this better tax rate will only be around for a year and a half to 2 years. That's not good enough. This is terrible. And they're kicking the can down the road because I think, one, they really truly don't believe the tax cuts work. And if you missed the show the other night, we talked about this. I went into it in great detail. This works because corporations with lots of money have the option of going elsewhere. They can. They can go to Ireland. They can go to another country that has a lower tax rate, 12%, 11%, 10%. And they do. We want those businesses back. And the only way you lure them back is by lowering the rate. Simple. But you've got to do it. You've got to do it now. So I hope the Senate doesn't. I hope they get kicked in the gut by the House of Representatives. And I think they might, because the House will be desperate to get reelected. And all those tickets are up in a short period of time. All right. 8 o'clock hour. Next hour, we're going to come up. I want to talk about this. There's been some developments. You know, Rand Paul, you know how he got assaulted while he was mowing his lawn? This story actually has taken an interesting turn, an interesting twist. It brings up one of my favorite pet topics that I don't know if I've shared with you. Yeah, I'm going to get into it. Trust me, it's interesting stuff. All right, Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation. We got John Wolf up next with the news. Don't go anywhere.
Talk radio. 790 KABC.
Greetings, friends. Welcome to the program. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC, 8 o'clock hour, Wednesday night. By the way, it's now with the time change. It's so dark. I realized that today. I'm on my way into the studio, and I'm starting to worry that I was running really late because it was so dark outside. Anyway. But it's nice too in the morning because I have to get up and go in the mornings, and it's a little bit difficult for me sometimes when it's super dark. So I like that the sun is up around six. It makes everything good. Now, you remember the story from about a week ago, Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, was mowing his lawn, and then suddenly He gets a neighbor of his who is a retired anesthesiologist named Rene Boucher, runs up to him and beats the crap out of Senator Rand Paul. The guy ended up with a contused lung. He had some fractured ribs, five fractured ribs. I mean, it's pretty crazy stuff. Now, everyone assumes, and I'm still not entirely convinced that it is something else, but everybody assumed that it was about a political dispute. Well, locals are talking to the media and apparently claim that the dispute had to do over something to do with lawn care and a longstanding resistance on the part of Rand Paul to conform with his association's homeowner rules.
Congressional Budget Office has found
now this really, I'll tell you, this really was funny to me. And the reason is, do you live in a homeowner association? Okay, well, Bill's shaking his head that no. A lot of people in L.A. don't. In Orange County, it's very difficult not to live in a homeowner association. And I read this, and I'll tell you, immediately there was a ring of truth to it. Because I absolutely detest homeowner associations. And I'll tell you why. If you don't live in one, you have not experienced what a neighbor of yours, you know, everybody has that one neighbor that likes to get into your business. What a neighbor like that really becomes when they are empowered with a position of authority over your personal life. Now, Rand Paul, he's a libertarian. He's a live and let live guy. Homeowner associations are not created at all for libertarians. They're actually the exact opposite. They're for people who want to conform. They're a little bit like little mini totalitarian states. You can have your bushes cut up to here. Your house has to be one of these, you know, three shades, these three pre-approved shades of beige. You have to keep your garage door closed at all times, except in the 3 seconds that you drive in and out. I'm not making this up. Can't park on the street, can't park in your driveway, can't park. I mean, these are the type of rules that are out there. And Rand Paul, he believes in property rights. So apparently this Boucher guy, this is where their dispute lay. Something to do with, I guess Rand Paul had a compost pile. And I don't think Boucher liked it, and it was against the rules. And this is where their brewing conflict developed. Now, some of you, I know some of you out there are thinking right now, yeah, this is exactly the kind of conflict I've had with people in an association. You know, this is a political program. We talk about politics. There's this maxim in politics that says the smaller the government, the smaller the town, excuse me, the smaller the town, the bigger the politics. And I remember, by the way, totally true, totally true. And this is why homeowner association boards are literally the worst. You know, I sat on one for a couple years in my association where I lived once upon a time. And I only took the seat because there were so many crazy people on the board that we needed one more normal vote. But it was literally probably one of the worst experiences of my life because there were people on the board that really wanted to micromanage everything in the neighborhood. And I would just sit there and I would shrug my shoulders and say, I don't think really we need to get into that. I don't think that's that big of a problem. Well, in the rules, it says that you can't. I think we're okay. I don't think that really. Well, Sam, you can't. And I think this is fascinating because I think that there's a political analogy to it. Remember that the reason that they thought that this was a politically motivated attack, assault on Senator Rand Paul is because they found out this Boucher guy is a registered Democrat. Listen, though, this is interesting. I really think that there are certain people who are obsessed not just about how they will run their own lives, but they are particularly obsessed with how other people run and manage theirs. And I think this is what ultimately is the foundation of my personal political orientation. Because I really want to worry about my life and I want you to worry about your life. You do you. I'm going to do me. And the less you are involved with me and the less I am involved with you, the better. Now, we can meet as friends and we can talk as humans and we can, even if we're different, we can find common ground. But all of that is much better the less you are involved in my life and the less some external, you know, people are telling us how we need to live. Associations. This is so funny. I guess Rand Paul lives in a gated community, which I get. You know, he's a senator. He probably provides some safety and security for him. But this gated community apparently has some strict rules. And he's the guy that just is a nonconformist, right? He's the guy that wants to do things exactly himself. And he argues with everybody, which is, isn't that how you picture him? Right? He's the guy, if everybody in Congress says, yeah, let's go along, he's the one guy who's marching in the other direction. So he doesn't, you know, he's not a groupthink guy. But I also, I think that homeowner associations tend to be the perfect place for little Democrats to do their thing and to get the first taste of what it feels like to have power and to be able to tell another person how to live their lives. and they love it. I mean, yeah, if you haven't experienced this, you're very fortunate. I know, though, that every person listening has at one point in time had a neighbor from hell. And I'm telling you that homeowner associations empower that neighbor to be an even bigger problem. Oh, we had a guy in our association who was on the board one time who'd personally walk around and do trash can inspections, because the homeowner rules were that you had to take the trash in at the end of the, you know, let's say the trash pickup was on a Wednesday, and, you know, by Friday morning you had to have your trash cans in. And then he'd have these stickers, and he'd personally, you know, he'd put them on the trash cans. You're in violation of homeowner code, you know, whatever. And I kept looking at this guy, and I swear to you, I kept looking at him and go, you know, I know you have a job. I know you're busy. You know, I know he's busy. How do you have time for this? But the bigger picture philosophically and politically is, you know, regulation, whatever kind of regulation it is expensive. Just like it takes him time to walk the neighborhood, this guy I was talking to you about, and putting stickers on trash cans, every, you know, that takes his time. Those stickers cost something. But every time that we put in a regulation, we go, yeah, we should regulate that. Congress, you know, make pass a law, and a law is passed, and there's a new regulation, a new code to be enforced. One of the things, one of the, you know, unintended consequences is that it costs money. It adds people to the bureaucracy. And if everything, the entire system becomes that much more less wieldy. Let me do that again. That much more unwieldy. And this is something that we don't think about, and we don't think through to its logical consequences. And it creates conflict. Conflict in the form of friction. I'm not saying people getting beat up, but I'm just saying you're now regulating something just for ultimately just for the sake of regulating it. And it starts, you start to see this type of thinking in homeowner associations. So this piece in the, where was this? Was this Bloomberg? They call it a trivial dispute. I don't think it's trivial. When it comes to a person's property, there's no such thing as trivial. I'm an enormous believer in owning land and owning property and owning, for example, your home. I think this is one of the great things that you can do. And by the way, one of the things that really distances us as a free country from places where you can't do this. In North Korea, you cannot own personal property or your land. Czechoslovakia, communist Czechoslovakia, where my parents grew up, this was property ownership is not something you could do. The state owned everything. And consequently to that, when the state owns everything, no one owns it. You know, it belongs to the state, it belongs to no one. There's no pride of ownership. This family that, you know, would otherwise own a little home somewhere and would take meticulous care of it because it was their pride and joy, now it belonged to some government agency. They didn't care about it because it's not theirs. The people working for the agency aren't keeping it up. And consequently, the piece of property falls into disrepair. The funny thing is that when we're left to our own devices in a free market, it tends to lead to pride of ownership, right? That's the natural result in anything that we do, whether it's a car, whether it's a career, whether it's a house, whether it's our family, right? The less we can rely on somebody else to help us, the more we have to take ownership of our lives. And I say kids, I don't mean you own kids, but I mean you have to take, if there's no state helping you, if there's no regulation telling you what to do and how to do it and what you should do with your kids and not, it's on you, pal. You got to figure out how to raise those kids. And that creates, I think it has historically, an incentive to get your act together. This is why historically, in years past, before we had a great society, when somebody became a parent, maybe by accident or a little bit too soon, then they went, that's when people had awakenings. Said, boy, I gotta get serious about this. I gotta get my life together. I gotta go get a job. I gotta provide. Today, the thought is, wow, better sign up for those government benefits. Maybe I need to get back into school, take out some student loans. Or hell, maybe I'll just bail on this kid altogether. So I actually think that in this story about Rand Paul getting beat up, there are so many interesting little lessons that can come from it. But I promise you, if you want to see the ugly side of a liberal's paradise, go to a homeowners association. Because there, you're going to see a super regulated, micro regulated world. And I don't, you know, none of that ever works. Master planning, too. This is another thing. There's this big idea that master planning is the answer. And I live in Irvine, which is master planned to perfection, quote unquote. As a consequence, Irvine is boring. There is nothing here. There's no center. There's no place to congregate. There's no, there's no heart and soul of the town. It just bleeds into Newport. It bleeds into Tustin. It bleeds into all the adjoining bedroom communities. When you allow people to settle as they will, beautiful little downtowns are built. Little main streets are created. You know, thriving commercial districts. People do separate this out. And again, this is one of those things. Zoning, master planning, and all of this. Sounds great on paper. Regulation, right? It sounds great. We're going to make things nice. We're going to make things clean. But really, if people are left to their own devices, you know, people don't want a factory next door. And that generally gets solved with time as property values go up. And it no longer is feasible to have a factory next door when you could sell the land and build condos or houses. So these type of things tend to resolve themselves. I just wanted to take a minute. Reading the story about Paul just made me laugh because I can see where the conflict is coming from. But it also underscores what it means to be a libertarian. What it means to allow people to do what they will. And that the best results in life come from situations where you let people be and you let them figure things out. I have a great example of this. I'm going to come back after the break here. I'll tell you a great example of a famous Czech industrialist who did this. And then we've got, it's been a year, since the election, since Trump won. And I have some really funny stories of what various reporters felt and did on the night they realized that Trump was winning. This is so good. I'm going to read some fantastic, sad stories for you. All right, don't go anywhere. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
News. Talk. Evolve. 790 KABC.
Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. I was just recounting the story of Rand Paul getting assaulted in front of his house, working on his lawn, and apparently some media reports saying that it wasn't really a political dispute, that it was a homeowner association dispute where one neighbor, the assaulter, believed that Rand Paul was flouting the rules of the association. That he was being, a little bit dismissive of what following the rules that the association put in place. So, anyway, I was talking a little bit about libertarianism because, of course, Rand Paul is a libertarian, and talking about how, you know, we just got to let people live and figure things out for themselves. That if you let people do things their way, it tends to be better. And there's self-regulation. Now, one great story about this that I really always liked. There was a very famous Czech industrialist in the interwar period called the First Republic in the what was then Czechoslovakia. His name was Thomas Baťa. He was a shoe manufacturer. And when he built his factory town, he didn't master plan it necessarily. I mean, he built buildings and he built some homes and built the factory. But one thing he did not build were any sidewalks. Why? What he did is he let people out there walk in the dirt for a number of months. And then, after looking at all the trails that they had made, he decided where the best place for a sidewalk would be. And I don't know, I don't know how it is where you live, but where I live, when I walk on sidewalks, they make sidewalks that look interesting and nice because they're master planned. It's some, you know, wonky architect that decided, oh, we're going to put the sidewalk, the walkway is going to go over here, and it's going to go over here, and it's going to go up over here, and this. And then what do as humans? We walk only on the portions of the sidewalk that make sense to us, and then create our own trails. And that's why when you're on those zigzaggy things, you always see the pass-through path, and then they always try to put up a little fence or something to make it impossible for you to follow your heart's desire. So I only bring this up to say that's smart planning, and it's where you give people an opportunity to first literally make their own paths. And the only people that really love associations and love master planning typically are liberals. Because it's their, that's exactly their way of thinking. Everybody must conform to me. Everybody must do what I do and say what I say. And let's all just live in a utopia that we've created. It's communism. It's literally communism. You know, I need time to develop this. So I'm going to start with a little bit of setup right now. I have to acknowledge the big anniversary yesterday of a momentous and important victory that Trump had, obviously one that many people did not see coming. And there is this great piece about journalists telling their stories, their election night horror stories. And, you know, for me, the big, not takeaway, but the big obvious thing with the story is that I'll read to you next segment here some of these reactions that they had. Now these are reporters, these are editors, other members of the media that are willingly and openly going on the record to tell us how in the tank they were for Hillary. And not only that, they're willing to go on the record with how much they despise and loathe Trump. So I have a question for you. Do you believe anything they say when they report on this presidency? Because that's really what you have to ask yourself. I mean, every night here, I rail against all these ridiculous pronouncements that are made in the media and such. But at the examining their bias here. And this isn't about, it's about their feelings a year ago, but this is them recounting these experiences today, now, in the last few days. This is all very current and contemporary to today. These people still hate him. They hate Trump. And yet they are so-called objective journalists. What a load of crap. All right, John Wolfe up next with the news. He's an objective journalist. Listen to John. He's good. And I'll be back right after this.
Try to make fun of everyone. KABC News live and local. It's 8:30. I am John Wolf. Vice President Mike Pence went to San Antonio.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. 790. KABC.
Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. And, well, I was just telling you before the break, there is a great piece commemorating the upset victory 1 year ago of one Donald Trump the Great when he surprised and shocked everybody that he won the presidential race. Anyway, a number of journalists have gone on the record to talk about their feelings, their emotions on that fateful night. And As I read the actual words of reporters that report for very well-known and supposedly objective publications, I just want you to think, can these people, if they felt this way a year ago and continue to feel this way today, enough to share this, are these the type of people that are being objective in their reporting about the president? I'll start with Rebecca Traister. She's a writer for New Yorker magazine. She went on the record to talk about her feelings. She was so confident that Clinton would be victorious on election night. And here is what she talks about. She talks about being at the Javits Center. Do you remember the Javits Center? That's where the big election victory party was supposed to happen for Hillary Clinton. And that's where Leon Panetta, you know, very late in the evening, shuffled up to the stage and just said, you know, hey, folks, I'm sorry. Nothing here to see. You know, we're just come back in the, you know, we'll be back to you in the morning. So here is what this Rebecca Traister character, so writer for The New Yorker magazine, is says about the evening as soon as it was clear that Hillary had lost. Do we have some music for this? Cue the music. I felt so alone. I knew it was done. I was by myself on the floor. I started to cry. I was thinking everything from, I'm going to have to rewrite my piece, to, can we even stay in the U.S.? I texted my husband, tell Rosie to go to bed. I don't want her to watch this. People were throwing up. People were on the floor crying. In the cab home, the cabbie had on the news, and that's when I heard his acceptance speech, and I said, can you turn it off? I just couldn't hear his voice. I was like, I can't listen to his voice for the next 4 years. I got back to Park Slope. I went to check on the girls. When I went to say goodnight, I looked at Rosie, and I had this conscious thought that this is the day that will divide our experience of what is possible. This is the day where a limitation is reinforced for her. All right. That's just one journalist. Yeah. Oh, and of course. How did I do on that, Robbie? I'm trying to capture this. People were throwing up. Tell my daughter she can't watch this. You know, by the way, I just a little side note on parenting. There's very little I don't want my kids to see when it comes to current events. Maybe this happens from, my father remembers, speaking of conscious, you know, conscious experiences, my father remembers getting bombed in World War II. So when it comes to raising children, I kind of think that kids need to be aware of what's going on. What a great opportunity to tell your kid, hey, look, this guy's the president, and this is why we disagree with him, and this is where our differences lie. And not, oh, don't even let her watch. Don't let her see this. The ogres have stormed the fortress. I mean, this is hysterical. There's another New Yorker. This is the editor of the New Yorker, David Remnick, discussed his sudden revelation that journalists need to put pressure on power. And here's what he says. Not only, this is his recollections from election night, not only did I not have anything else ready, I don't think our site, he's talking about his website and content, I don't think our site had anything or much of anything ready in case Trump won. They were totally unprepared. That stuff is good. Anyway, so look, don't go anywhere. I got more of this when we come back. It's hilarious. I think this stuff is funny. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. 790 KABC.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation here, speaking out for my friend, sweet James Bergner, the one and only attorney to trust. If you're in an accident, an injury, gets, you know, trampled by an elephant at the zoo, I mean, whatever type of injury it is, make sure you've got the right guy representing you. And he is attorney sweet James Bergner. I know him well. I can vouch for him. He's got a good heart. Sharp eye, and most importantly, he knows how to take your case and get you what you deserve. Very easy. You just give him a call. Easy to talk to. He'll take you through everything that needs to happen. 1-800-881-2021. That's his number. Keep that close. 1-800-881-2021. Or visit his website, sweetjames.com. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Now, right before the break, I was telling you, I was reading to you some excerpts of journalists that are basically have got their themselves all worked up over the tragedy that was Clinton's decisive defeat last November. I just mentioned before the break there was the editor of the New Yorker, David Remnick, decided that, you know, that he would have to, as part of his mission, he would have to put pressure on power once Trump was elected. He said that night I went to an election night party. As Clinton's numbers started to sour, I took my laptop out, got a chair, found a corner, and started thinking and writing. Can I just point something out? Where were these dummies during 8 years of Obama? I think by his own admission that he hadn't started thinking until Trump got elected. That's how I'm reading this. Now, Jelani Cobb. Well, listen, this is we're going to continue. David Remnick here of The New Yorker. We'll talk about another author here. Let me just read this to you. This is great. Listen to this. So David Remnick says, Jelani Cobb and I spoke around midnight. We were both, well, let's put it this way, in The New Yorker mode of radical understatement, disappointed. Jelani's disappointment extended to his wondering whether he should actually leave the country. He wasn't kidding around. I could tell that from his voice. We agreed that night, and we agree today, that the Trump presidency is an emergency. And in an emergency, you have got a purpose, a job to do, and ours is to put pressure on power. That's always the highest calling of journalism, but never more so than when power is a constant threat to the country and in radical opposition to its values and its highest sense of itself. Oh my goodness. Are you moved by this? I am. What else? This is a good one here. I don't need any music for this because this would need, I need like a banjo. Do you have any banjo music? You guys, no help to me. Washington Post reporter Dave Weigel, whatever his name is, opined that most of the people he saw at an Atlanta airport who looked like him, quote unquote, a white dude with a mustache, fairly bloated by the campaign, voted for Trump, who, as far as they knew, was a quote-unquote bigot. So this guy talks about how right after the election, he's going home, very long, sad face. But he's a little chubby because he was on the campaign trail, eating a lot of donuts or whatnot. And he suddenly realizes at the Atlanta airport, he's like, oh my gosh, I look like I'm deplorable. I look like a big fat white guy with a mustache. I look like a Trump voter. And he suddenly started to feel really obsessed with standing out and being judged. This is kind of like, you know, maybe 50 years ago, you having some really cool, you know, pink shorts as a guy and be like, oh my gosh, I think these guys think I might be gay. I mean, it was this same type of shock and concern. Do you know how bigoted this is? Do you know how he thinks that every fat guy with a mustache is a Trump voter? And he works for the Washington Post. I mean, this, these are the people that are supposed to be our guiding light. Give me a break. Don't go anywhere. Actually, I'll take a break right now.
News. Talk. Evolve. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, live on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Now, you know, pardon me, I'm having a bit of fun here reading these crybaby journalists recalling their experiences on the night that Trump won the election. Well, okay. There's this other one. There's, who is this? This is Anna Marie Cox, and she's the senior political correspondent for MTV News. Okay, I realize this isn't the New York Times or anything, but it's, you know, still a news source that some people trust. She recalls how some of her friends worried about their future on election night. She says a Muslim colleague of mine called his mother. She was worried he was going to be the victim of violence at any moment. By the way, you remember this? There's supposed to be blood in the streets immediately. I mean, Trump's election would mean the end of the rule of law. Cox said a colleague who is gay and married was on the phone with her wife saying, "They're not going to take this damn ring away from me." I remember when Obama won. And I remember not being happy about it. Guys, let me tell you. Let me explain how much I did not like Obama winning. Now, he played it really safe in the election. But when you go back and you look at Obama's radical past and all that stuff that wasn't reported on by the mainstream media, who were carrying water for him, who if they gave him half, if they put half the spotlight on Obama that they had, that they're putting on Trump today, Obama would have never gotten reelected. Like, no way, no how. But anyway, I digress. I knew that Obama was a radical, that he had these, you know, grew up around socialists and communists and various agitators. And to me, these people are literally the anathema of what America is all about. So I was very worried about this country, just like these people claim they were. Yeah, election night happened. I was disappointed. I remember actually vividly, I have a distinct memory. I heard Obama's speech and I said, well, let's hope he's not as bad as we fear. And then I think I even said something to my wife about, you know, nothing is as good or as bad as it seems. Funny enough, 8 years later, that is exactly the line that I used on election night. Because this time I was really happy. And again, I said, nothing is as good or as bad as it seems. Right now, we're very excited. We got a guy in who could potentially be transformational, but he could also fail spectacularly. I don't know. Yes, there was a bit of air guitar that night. Part of what I think, why am I enjoying this so much? Part of why I like reading these stories is because I was so excited. We had the best party. By the way, I want to point out a very diverse group of people that came to my house. I don't remember, Robbie, were you there that night? You were there. Now, you can vouch for it. Very diverse group. I realize that according to the Washington Post, David Weigel thinks that as far as Trump voters go, a white dude with a mustache fairly bloated is an apt description. There weren't very many white dudes with mustaches that were fairly bloated. We had people of all backgrounds at the house, and they were all very excited, and partly because, you know, they were, you know, business owners and people who were hoping for a little more hospitable climate. And they're getting that. Anyway, all of this to say, these reporters that are going on the record with this drivel, with this silly, idiotic blabble about their emotional reactions, I have two observations. One, who gives a crap about your damn feelings? You're a journalist. You're supposed to report the facts. Since when do your feelings matter to me? Your feelings are not worth the paper they're printed on. Literally, which is why your newspapers aren't selling and, you know, why your business model's in the toilet. So that's one observation. The other one is, why does it matter what's in the New York Times? Why does it matter what's in the New Yorker? Why does it matter what the Washington Post writes? When these are the people that they employ, well, of course, They hate Trump. They're anti-Trump. Everything that they do, unnamed sources inside the administration claim that Trump had a bad day. Trump's walking around the halls, talking to himself, yelling at paintings. Do you remember this? Like how he was stalking the hallways, just falling apart. This is so funny to me. Every time you read an article about Trump, let's say you hate him. Let's say you want those things in the article to be true. Sorry, they're not. Because the people writing the article, if you don't like Trump, they're in the same boat as you, only like times 100. So that's what this is. It's fiction. And the fiction is meant to assuage their feelings. That's why I wanted to tell you about their feelings. Their feelings are so important to them. And everything they do is a consequence of trying to make their feelings better. All right. This time I know, unlike on Monday, I didn't know I was ending the show. I know I'm ending the show tonight. It's the end. I'll be back on Friday, and I hope to talk to you then. We'll